Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Hertzgard, The Nation magazine's investigative editor at large, who discusses growing concern about Donald Trump's fitness for office and the president's unilateral control of the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. Chip Gibbons with the group Defending Rights and Dissent, who talks about the chilling effect of a government demand for data on 1.3 million people who visited a website that organized protest at Trump's inauguration. And John Lugo, a founder of the immigrant rights group Unidad Latina en Acción, who describes how New Haven, Connecticut became one of the nation's leading sanctuary cities. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs escalated when police carried out a deadly raid on the home of Mayor Reynaldo Parahino on the island of Mindanao. The late-night raid killed the mayor, his wife, brother, sister, and his security guards. The mayor of Ozamiz was among 150 Philippine government officials, including mayors, judges, and police officers, that Duterte had linked with the drug trade. Since Duterte was sworn in as president last July, over 7,000 people have been killed in his violent campaign against drugs, including two other mayors. Police claim they were attempting to serve the mayor a search warrant for drugs and weapons, but Human Rights Watch questioned official accounts of the raid, noting police had cut the feed to security video cameras. Parahino's daughter, who serves as vice mayor, accused the police of planting drugs at the scene. Philippines opposition senator Panfilo Lacson warned that the deaths create the impression that search warrants are merely being used by the Philippine National Police to facilitate extrajudicial killing. Senator Leila de Lima, a prominent opposition figure, called the incident a plain and simple extermination. At least two senators have called for an investigation. In mid-August, in a town north of Manila, police engaged in the bloodiest night of Duterte's murderous anti-drug campaign when 32 people were killed and over 100 alleged low-level drug dealers were arrested. Indian and Chinese soldiers briefly clashed in the disputed Kashmir region of the Himalayas in mid-August, with soldiers throwing stones at each other near Pangong Lake, a major tourist destination. Indian police officials told the Guardian newspaper that summer clashes were relatively common along the de facto border, known as the line of actual control, but this season's conflict has been prolonged. The two nations have been engaged in a series of border disputes along their 2,000-mile common border in the Himalayas. In June, Indian soldiers halted a Chinese road-building project in the Doklam region, declaring that the construction violated Bhutan's border, a close Indian ally. China demanded that India withdraw its troops before any proper negotiation can begin. India countered with a proposal that both sides withdraw their forces at the same time. China and India waged a brief war in 1962 over disputed territory in the Himalayas. The dispute is putting pressure on Bhutan, a small Buddhist nation with deep ties to both China and India. Bhutan receives substantial aid from and sells hydroelectric power to New Delhi. The ongoing border dispute could prompt Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to skip a major summit of emerging economies in Xiamen, China, in early September. The rally of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and militia groups in Charlottesville, Virginia, that resulted in the death of anti-racist protester Heather Heyer, was the largest gathering of the far right in a generation. Right-wing extremist groups, which fragmented in the aftermath of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing carried out by domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh that killed 168, are eager to display a new clean, frat boy image, which was on display during the Tiki Torchlight March in Charlottesville on the University of Virginia campus. According to ProPublica, most of the young white male racist activists in Charlottesville were from newly organized groups like Vanguard America, Identity Europa, and the Traditional Workers' Party. These are elements of the emergent racist movement inspired by 39-year-old Richard Spencer, president of the white supremacist think tank, the National Policy Institute. According to Charlottesville rally organizer Eli Mosley, Donald Trump's blatantly racist presidential campaign and victory has energized a whole wave of young people. Mosley noted that Trump has been a welcome megaphone for far-right ideas. The president's comments, claiming that many of those attending the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville were fine people, were publicly praised by many racist and fascist group leaders. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Before the media spotlight shifted away from the dangerous war of words between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to the tragic events in Charlottesville, the nation and the world had become alarmed at the apparent threat of a nuclear confrontation on the Korean Peninsula. Not since the days of the Cold War between the U.S. and Soviet Union had any two nations rattled their nuclear-armed sabers against each other in such a dangerous fashion. In response to a string of typical taunts from Kim Jong-un and his nation's increasing capability to launch nuclear-armed missiles that could reach the U.S. mainland, President Trump issued an extraordinary ultimatum to Pyongyang on August 8th, warning the isolated communist government not to make any more threats or they will face fire and fury like the world has never seen. Your reporter spoke with author Mark Hertzgard, the Nation magazine's investigative editor at large. Here, Hertzgard discusses his recent Nation article titled, "Do You Trust Donald Trump's Finger on the Nuclear Button?" examining growing concern about Donald Trump's fitness for office and the president's unilateral control of the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal.
Of course, immigration matters. Of course, health care and Obamacare matters. Of course, Black Lives Matter and all the other issues we can talk about, but those are issues where you can lose today and resume the fight tomorrow. With nuclear weapons, that's not the case. You know, you get one chance, you go wrong one time, and it can be all over. And, you know, only climate change has that kind of impact, but climate change does not have that short of a fuse. And such a hair trigger aspect of the nuclear crisis. And I say this again as a reporter, I've covered nuclear weapons since the 1980s during the Reagan-Gorbachev years, and I haven't been this frightened, frankly, since those days before Gorbachev arrived and the U.S. and the Soviets were very, very close, a lot of bellicose rhetoric and very close, much closer than most people realized at the time, to nuclear war. Now, we have someone as commander-in-chief who, forget Donald Trump's politics, forget his ideology, forget his racism and all the rest of it, just compare his temperament to every other U.S. president, Democrat or Republican, that we have had since World War II ended with the nuclear weapons and we opened the nuclear age. There has not been one president who has been this erratic, this impulsive, this uninformed, this easily baited, this vindictive, somebody who many psychologists have said is arguably mentally ill. This is not somebody who should be able to decide unilaterally, whether we go to nuclear war. And that's, again, a situation that existed before Donald Trump. It's been true for basically every president since Kennedy, where we have our weapons on a hair trigger, just as the Soviets and now the Russians do. And the argument was always, okay, the president has to be able to fire back immediately. 6 minutes is the waiting period. And that's why every president in the United States has always been shadowed by a senior military officer who is carrying the so-called nuclear football. That's the launch codes. He is never more than 15 feet away from the president. If the president suddenly takes an elevator ride up to the top of some building, that person is in there with the nuclear codes. And that is what, to me, is most scary about Donald Trump. He does not have to ask anyone to push that button. He can choose to ask people, but he's under no obligation. And he can unilaterally start a nuclear war. Maybe he just decides, okay, I've had enough in North Korea. They need to be taught a lesson. And he could give the order. Now, that to me is a very terrifying situation that should unite everyone across the political spectrum, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, an anarchist. It doesn't matter. everyone should be worried about this individual's temperament having his finger on the nuclear button.
Describe for our listeners this legislation that has been initiated in Congress, Restricting First Use of Nuclear Weapons Act of 2017. As I understand it, this was in the works before Donald Trump was elected president.
Correct.
But where are things at with that, and how can our listeners support it?
You're talking about the Markey-Lew legislation, as it's known. That's named after Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who is one of the co-sponsors, and then Congressman Ted Lieu, who is actually a military veteran. He's from out in California. And they are two Democrats, and nobody on Capitol Hill currently gives that piece of legislation a high chance of passage. But it's important to, especially at moments like this, to talk about it, because I think the circumstances on the ground are going to lead more people to support it. And basically what the legislation does, it's a reformist piece of legislation, but it's a smart reform. It basically says that a nuclear first strike can only be launched by the President of the United States if Congress agrees. That is a nuclear first strike, not a retaliatory strike, but a nuclear first strike. And they say there's no argument that if we launch nuclear weapons at somebody, that is war. And only Congress has the constitutional authority to declare war. And so the Lieu Markey legislation would essentially require any president, this president or any president, before they do a first strike, to consult with Congress. It's a small step, but in this current situation, it's a very important one. The other thing that needs to be done immediately is to take our nuclear weapons, and to talk to the Russians about this, obviously, to take both sides' nuclear weapons off of hair trigger alert. There's no reason for us to be on hair trigger alert. 6 minutes of window for decision making. Vladimir Putin in Russia has an even shorter 4 minute time. There's too many, in the history of nuclear weapons over the last 60 plus years now, there's too many times where we've had almost accidental war because of miscalculation, or you see the wrong thing on the radar screen, and you think that that flock of birds is a nuclear attack, or you think that that Norwegian weather satellite launch is a nuclear attack. And both of those are real incidents that we barely escaped. So we need to get the weapons off of hair trigger. We need to prevent a first strike. And the Ted Lieu and Ed Markey legislation would do that. And I think that it'd be very important if and when people talk to their members of Congress and their representatives to do both of those things, support that legislation. But in the meantime, call the Pentagon, call the White House, and say that Trump is not allowed to make this decision unilaterally.
That was Mark Hertzgard, The Nation magazine's investigative editor-at-large and the author of 7 books, including Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. Find links to Hertzgard's recent article on Donald Trump's unilateral capability to launch a nuclear war and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Trump Justice Department, under Jeff Sessions, is demanding data from a web hosting company on more than 1.3 million IP addresses, as well as the email addresses and photos of thousands of people who'd visited a website that organized protests at Donald Trump's January 20th inauguration in Washington, D.C. The search warrant was approved by Judge Robert Wertheim. DreamHost, the company targeted, which hosted the DisruptJ20.org website, has thus far refused to comply with a Justice Department search warrant, declaring that the order constitutes investigatory overreach and a clear abuse of government authority. Civil liberties advocates raised alarm that the government's demand would chill dissent and free speech. The Justice Department has indicated that the demand for this data is linked with more than 200 people who were arrested on felony riot charges during the inauguration for allegedly engaging in property destruction, such as breaking store windows and setting a limousine on fire. Some of those arrested in police sweeps were journalists and legal observers. Your reporter spoke with Chip Gibbons, policy and legislative director with the group Defending Rights and Dissent. Here Gibbons explains why he believes that this search warrant is designed to silence dissent and make people afraid to speak out.
The Justice Department claims there is evidence relating to the D.C. felony rioting statute that they can obtain. Their warrant demands practically all company records and information associated with the website. If DreamHost was to comply with the request, they would have to hand over roughly 1.3 million visitor IP addresses, in addition to contact information, email content, and photos of thousands of visitors to the website. They would have to give the content of all the email inquiries people sent to the website and comments submitted from numerous private email accounts. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, this is an absurd amount of information to look for to have an isolated incident of rioting. I mean, it's such a broad warrant. It's at the best a fishing expedition, and it's at the worst, and this is what I suspect, it is an attempt to chill dissent.
To their credit, the web hosting company DreamHost is fighting this search warrant. What effective measures are they taking to try to tamp down this Justice Department request for this data?
They're trying to fight the warrant by saying it's unconstitutional, as well as it violates some U.S. statutes. Their argument is that it is a Fourth Amendment search that has potentially First Amendment information that could be gathered from it, and therefore there needs to be a higher standard in reviewing it. It has to have particular exactitude, and that it's not a very exact warrant. There's also claims that it breaks the Privacy Act and some other constitutional claims. It comes very close to me to reading like a general warrant, which of course the general warrants from the colonial days are what the Fourth Amendment is supposed to prevent from happening. But even beyond the Fourth Amendment issue, I mean, we have the First Amendment issue. They are getting the information about people who engaged in First Amendment protected activity. I don't ever want to make predictions about these kinds of things, but I am cautiously optimistic. I read EFF's legal brief on behalf of DreamHost. I think it's very well argued and very well reasoned. I think this warrant is shocking. But you know, if you yourself want to take action, a number of groups, including Defending Rights in Dissent, are gathering signatures to Jeff Sessions, asking him to withdraw the warrant. If you want to sign one of those, you can go to www.rightsanddissent.org. And while you know legal victories are important, I also think social movement victories are important. And while I know people are probably thinking Jeff Sessions is not the most sympathetic recipient of a petition like this, I think it's really important to show that regardless of what we think of Jeff Sessions will do, that there's political opposition, he's politically mobilized against it. I think that we've seen a lot of some of the worst instincts of the Trump administration curtailed by popular movements. And I think if they see how horrified people are by this, and those people start speaking out, that will send a powerful message. Because, you know, the purpose of this warrant is to silence people, but we need to be speaking out right now about it.
What's the danger here in terms of the legal precedent that could be set if the Justice Department gets their way and they get this data that would give them specific information on how to find some 1.3 million people who visited this website, this anti-Trump organizing website?
I mean, I think the biggest danger is that it's going to chill speech. I mean, I think many people don't want the Trump administration to be compiling a list of anti-Trump people with their name on it. So if people know that if you go to the Disrupt J20 website, you could get your name sent to the Department of Justice, you might think twice about going to a different anti-Trump website. And then, you know, people aren't organizing. There's also the conflation of activism with criminality here. And I think that this is just all part of a larger program to crack down on dissent. You see it with the warrant, you see it with these prosecutions, and you see it in state legislatures across the country that are trying to pass these really awful bills meant to deter people from protesting.
That was Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Director with the group Defending Rights in Dissent. After this interview was conducted, the Department of Justice dropped its demand for IP addresses, but still seeks subscriber account information. For more analysis and commentary on these issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This summer, New Haven, Connecticut has welcomed two undocumented immigrants from two different countries that have taken sanctuary in two city churches. New Haven, a city of 130,000 and home of Yale University, was the first municipality in the country to grant resident ID cards regardless of citizenship in 2007. Nuri Chavarria, a Guatemalan refugee and mother of four who lived in Norwalk, Connecticut, sought sanctuary in New Haven on July 21st after Immigration and Customs Enforcement ordered her deportation. She took refuge in the city's La Iglesia de Dios Pentecostal Church. After 5 days, ICE issued a stay of deportation, allowing her attorney to appeal her case and permitting Chavarria to return to her family and job. On August 8th, Ecuadorian immigrant Marco Antonio Reyes, a father of three from Meriden, Connecticut, took refuge in First and Summerfield Methodist Church, also in New Haven. As of August 22nd, he remains there. Chavarria has lived in the U.S. for 24 years, Reyes for 20. Today, New Haven proudly and defiantly proclaims itself a sanctuary city, but it was a combination of top-down and bottom-up strategies that resulted in the city declaring itself a sanctuary for at-risk immigrants. City mayors, past and present, along with the faith community and the grassroots immigrant rights group Unidad Latina en Acción, all played important roles in making New Haven a safe haven for those hoping to avoid deportation. Between the Lines' Melinda Tujus spoke with John Jairo Lugo, a founder of Unidad Latina en Acción in 2002. Here he describes how various forces came together to declare New Haven one of the nation's leading sanctuary cities.
And maybe some people will disagree with me, but I feel like all the good things happening in New Haven regarding the sanctuary city is because we started a conversation many years ago. And I think, I believe that those conversations started back in 2002 when we, as a community, we get together and we brainstorm about how to make New Haven a model city, to pass some kind of policy where, like, the police doesn't call immigration and our people, the ID card, the translation of the, you know, public documents at the city in Spanish. So we're the ones who brought all these conversations, you know. We're the ones who convinced them that there was a good thing for the city and it was a good thing also for the community. So I don't want to say, like, it's Unidad Latina only, no, because, like, it has been, like, Unidad Latina, but also has been, in the past, has been Junta, the support of, like, a community leaders, and then, you know, like, the city officials.
So the fact that you got the city officials on your side, did that make it easier to get what you wanted?
Yeah, of course, you know, like, when you had, like, all the, when I say city official, I call them the politicians, when you had the politicians on your side, because they're the ones who has the power to change, like, the local laws, you know, so, or, like, to pass resolutions, so, yes.
So in the past month or so, there have been two people who came from two different cities in Connecticut to New Haven to seek sanctuary, and they were both basically on the verge of flying back to their native countries, which was, you know, Guatemala and Ecuador, even though both had been here 120 years and 124 years. They had no criminal offenses. And they came to New Haven to seek sanctuary. One is from Norwalk, one is from Meriden. Why do you think that was?
That's part of my frustration. It's like I love Nuri and I love Marco. And, you know, like when they came to asking for help, you know, the different organizations that they helped them, you know, we agreed to, like, be on their side, you know, because we have been talking, you know, like, since the beginning of the year, how we can start, like, putting together, like, a list of churches to become, like, sanctuary, because we thought that this kind of situation will happen eventually. But my thing and my frustration is more related to, like, the lack of organizing in many other cities around the state, you know. So New Haven, yes, we have been doing the work, you know, for, like, 15 years. But then, you know, I don't see, like, the same level of organizing in other cities. And everybody look at New Haven as an example, which is pretty good, you know, for us. But at the same time, I hope, you know, like, these two cases will you know, help, you know, like to open a bigger conversation on how each community and each city, they should be doing their own organizing, because this is just the beginning on the attacks on the immigrant community. I really believe that it's going to be worse. What is going to happen when we have, like, I don't know, 50 people seeking sanctuary? We now have enough space in New Haven to house them, you know. So I think this is like maybe the right time to start having the conversation and going back, you know, like to these communities like Norwalk, Bridgeport, Meriden, Hartford, and, you know, and start like talking about real organizing.
Is there anything that you want to say about sanctuary and the nitty gritty when you actually, you know, interact with the person who's hoping to not have to go back to their home country?
Yeah, I think I see Marco every day. I spend like most of my day here at this church with him. But I had to say, and that's maybe a call to everybody who's listening, the secret of sanctuary is like to, when you get like a support from the community, when you see the community like writing letters to him, when you see the community stopping by the church and give him like support, moral support, you know. So I think, you know, he's doing okay. This is just like his second week, and I think it's going to get harder, and I think his hope, it will be increase or decrease depending on how much support he has from the community and how much support the people show to him, you know, because it's not just like saying, oh, that's nice, that's happening in New Haven. No, I think it's important to come into New Haven and seeing by yourself what's happening in this church, you know, and how, you know, the community works with directly with the faith community, and how these buildings, you know, became like a refuge for people who are in jeopardy to be deported.
That was John Jairo Lugo, a founder of New Haven, Connecticut's grassroots immigrant rights group, Unidad Latina en Acción. Learn more about New Haven's Sanctuary City movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on deprogrammedradio.org in Norwich, Norfolk, United Kingdom, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.